Hare Krishna, this is May 18th, 2008, Columbus, Ohio, Hridayananda Das Goswami's celebration of his 36th anniversary of taking sannyas.
Since the late 80s, he distinguished himself for his eloquence, devotion, and dedication to studying the writings of the spiritual masters. In 1974, he was named a member of the Emissary Body of the ISKCON, where he was entered for the development of Krishna consciousness in Radhika. In the following 3 years, he established 25 centers of the society and attracted thousands of Radhika to Krishna consciousness. He is also the founder of Spanish Portuguese BBD, which has distributed 25 million books all over North America. The biggest challenge in his career came when the leaders of ISKCON, recognizing his profound devotional dedication, entrusted him to complete the Srila Prabhupada's commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. He is the first Westerner to be entrusted with this laborious task, and his success in communicating the essence of India's spiritual heritage has been noticed by the leaders of the whole world. In 1996, he received his PhD in Sanskrit and Indian Studies from the University of Harvard. His present project is a translation and adaptation of the Indian epic of Mahabharata. He's also currently finishing his first novel, a modern exciting drama, meant to capture the general public while translating Krishna conscious philosophy and values. So, let's give a big round of applause for his very amazing.
Hare Krishna!
Hare Krishna!
Thank you all for coming, even when you heard that I was also coming. So, we're going to... Do you all know Radha Madhava, the song Radha Madhava? Most of you know. Those of you who don't know it can fake it. There she is. Here she says, anyone need a sheet?
Thank you.
Namaste Narasinghaya.
Namaste Narasinghaya.
Pralada Tahine. Jaya Vishnu Paha Paramahamsa Parivajakachara Sadhar Satsi Kualiti Bhakti Vrachandra Vahki Jaya. ISKCON Founder Acharya Sri Prabhupada Ki Jaya. Jaya Vishnu Paha Paramahamsa Parivajakachara Sadhar Satsi Kualiti Bhakti Siddhan Saraswati Thakur Ki Jaya. Nandakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jaya. Namacharya Sri Haridas Thakur Ki Jaya. Prem Sakala Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda. Jadaita Gadadhar Sivasati Gold Bhakti Vrindaki Jaya. Sisi Radha Krishna Gogopinatha. Shankunda Radha Kundi Giri Govardhan Ki Jaya. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jaya. Mayapur Dham Ki Jaya. Jagannath Swami Ki Jaya. Gangamayi Ki Jaya. Jamunamayi Ki Jaya. Tulsi Devi Ki Jaya. Bhakti Devi Ki Jaya. Saveta Bhakti Vrindaki Jaya. Sri Bhagavan Narasingha Ki Jaya. Bhagavan Sri Narahari Ki Jaya. Prahlad Maharaj Ki Gaur Premanandi. So, I'd like to especially welcome all our guests who may not be regular participants in these programs. So, today is a special day, of course, for us. It's the appearance day, Lord Nrsimha Day. And although some of us are very familiar with these things, there really are some important philosophical and theological concepts underlying the celebration, which may not be obvious to people who are not familiar with this particular spiritual culture. So, I thought I would pull out some of those premises and assumptions and talk about them. So, Hare Krishna. It's just water. I'm not one of those religious leaders about to be arrested for something. I think, to the best of my knowledge. So, first of all, language like Appearance Day, for us, for those of us who are immersed in this culture, we use that language all the time. It's not a term which most people in the world use very often. We have birthdays and things like that, but so I'm going to attempt to sketch out a broad, you could say, philosophical map of what's going on here. So everybody, you know, it's like a navigation system, philosophical navigation system. So people, everyone can figure out where they are and if they need to flee or not. So. First of all, if you look at world religions, if you look at the histories and philosophies of world religions, it is not as chaotic as some people think. It's become a cliche nowadays to say that there are so many religions and they all think they're right and everybody else is wrong and they all contradict each other. And therefore, the only really rational approach is to consider that all of them kind of need to be medicated. And there is no real absolute truth. They're just a bunch of people making fanatical claims. Now, people that say that typically have not actually taken the trouble of studying world religions. It's kind of like, they think it's kind of like world religion street smarts or something. Like, that's what I hear on the street, you know. Everyone thinks they're right. So, if you actually take the trouble to study world religions, what you find is that it's not simply this hopeless chaos of competing fanatical views. It's actually very different. What you find is that there are... First of all, you can divide religious claims or religious beliefs into two very broad categories. One category is those who believe that there's some type of positive divine power which is responsible for the world existing and somehow responsible for, or at least controlling our existence. I mention that now, I'm using sort of a technical legal definition of religion, because if you think religion means you believe in God in some form or soul, that's, of course, I mean, this is America, and you can organize all kinds of corporations and call them religions, and you're not required to believe in God and a soul. You're simply, basically required to have a sincere interest in tax exemption. Anyway, apart from that, it is a fact that you could say from the sociological point of view that there are many groups claiming to be religions who don't believe in God or soul. A very famous example is Buddhism. Now again, that's somewhat simplistic because if you look at Buddhism, so to speak, on the ground in Asia, Asia is a very big place, which Americans just think it's some place basically west of California or something. But actually, Asia is a very big place, and there are a lot of different cultures there. And Buddhism, of course, began in India and spread to many parts of Asia. And it's something like, well, take a river. As a river flows through, let's say a river that is a very long river, like goes for hundreds or thousands of miles, as it flows through different topographical or geological environments, the river picks up different minerals, deposits different things, may pick up all kinds of interesting things like radioactive chemical waste or something. So, but the river, in a sense, the chemical composition of the river changes as it flows through different environments. And so in the same way, as religions migrate and travel and go here and there, even though they may start with some, you know, in the founder's mind, some pure message, religions do interact with all kinds of different cultural environments. And when your religion teaches that there is no real God, that's kind of like a green light for speculation. And so if you look at the history of Buddhism, of course it began in India, and apart from what the historical Buddha taught, and that's another issue, it eventually evolved within India into a culture which claimed there was no God and soul. As it traveled all over Asia, picked up all kinds of different ideas, it became many things. But still, that's an example of religion which basically, at least the mainstream historical Buddhism, tended to claim there's no God or soul, with about 20 footnotes on that statement. So, and then there are religions that say there is a God, or there is some kind of divine reality. Now, among the religions that say there is a God, or there is some kind of positive, spiritual, eternal reality, which the Buddhists, at least some of their sort of philosophers rejected. Although on the ground, they all tended to worship guardian angels and gods and things, because like everybody else, they wanted to know that, you know, where mommy went, like, did she go to heaven? So anyway, but, and then among the people that believe in some kind of positive spiritual reality, again, they can be divided into two groups, personalists and impersonalists. In other words, those who believe that ultimately the highest truth, the spiritual truth, divine power, however they understand it, is personal. And those who believe it's not personal. Now, putting aside for now those who don't even believe in God or the soul, because I think they're not really spiritual, and I don't mean that as an insult, I just mean that since the word spiritual is an adjective formed from the noun spirit, and since they don't believe in something like a spirit, I think it's not bigoted to deny them the adjective derived from a noun they don't believe in. I think that's fair. So, if we want to talk about the spiritual traditions, this personal-impersonal divide is very significant because, I don't know if you've noticed it lately, but you're a person. So, because we are all persons, ultimately, how you understand where you come from, what your ultimate roots are, is going to say a lot about who you ultimately are. I mean, that's very popular now, going back to your roots, like where your ancestors come from. For example, now in American universities, it's common that, it's interesting, if you study sort of the demographics and the sociology of Hindu studies courses in universities, I mean, there was a time, say back in the 60s, when everyone was searching, and so all kinds of young people would flock to courses on Eastern philosophy and religion. And then the market became kind of saturated. And so now you find many Indian American college students taking courses like that, Sanskrit or whatever, because they want to find their roots. And Oprah Winfrey, I think, was in a movie about her roots. The movie's called Roots. And remarkably enough, it was about roots. So, because after all, if you think of this word roots, the word root, of course, is taken from the realm of botany. And if you think of a tree, there's sort of an amusing word in Sanskrit. There are actually many amusing words in Sanskrit. We tend to be very serious and grave about Sanskrit, but it's actually a language that has a tremendous sense of humor. And one example is that one common word for tree is padapa, which means a foot drinker. It doesn't mean that people, you know, put feet in blenders and then drink them. It means that they drink through their feet. So a tree is, in fact, there's a word used in the song of the six Goswamis, padapa, kalpa, padapa, tale, and so on. So a foot drinker, so just as a tree drinks through its root, so in the same way, there's a sense in which we get nourished by our roots. If you take this analogy seriously, we want to find our roots because that nourishes us. We grow out of our roots, and there's a sense in which we become nourished by staying strongly connected to that out of which we grew. I mean, that's a very simple point, isn't it? I mean, it's even true in the realm of psychology where people want to, you know, go back and revisit their childhood and their relationship with their parents and their siblings and all those things. There's the idea that I have to have a positive, healthy relationship with my roots because I grew out of my roots. And because I grew out of them, what I am really has a lot to do with what I came from. And therefore, I mean, you see the point. It's a very simple point. So, therefore, when we talk about is God ultimately personal or impersonal, this is not a typical example of religious people with too much time on their hands. Just quarreling about technical points which no one else in the world really cares about. It's like, well, let me know when you figure that out, but in the meantime, you know, do you know the score of the, what is it now, you know, latest baseball game or something, whatever sport is now absorbing the minds of very intelligent people. So, the idea is that it's not just a technical point, it's not a frivolous discussion, because I should think that any intelligent person would want to know where they come from. And you're now a person, you have consciousness, you have feelings, and you have will, you have the power to think, which some people in this country actually occasionally exercise. Although too much of it, of course, is not recommended. If you think too much, I guess take an Advil and go to sleep. So, I mean, I'm being facetious because this country is, it's just like a boat on the water. The faster a boat goes on the water, the more it hydroplanes. It actually gets above the water. So the pace of life is so rapidly accelerated that, as I put it, basically, certainly in this country, increasingly around the world, people are intellectually hydroplaning. They're just skimming the surface of the deep issues of life. And no one has time to think about these things. So the world is kind of intellectually hydroplaning at the present moment. But actually, there are serious issues. So where do we come from, if God is impersonal, if ultimately there is no personal God, then it makes it very likely that you, or me, I mean, what we are right now, we're persons, is not ultimately real, that at some point you have to give it up. And if you give up your individual personal life, it means you give up your freedom. It means you give up your power to make decisions. It means you give up your right to love whom you choose. And to assume. You give up a lot. So, obviously, here in Krishna consciousness, we are very strong advocates, perhaps the strongest philosophical advocates at the present time in our culture, of a personal God. And there's a lot at stake. it actually astonishes me that people, some people, are so eager to commit philosophical suicide. I mean, after all, physical suicide clearly is not the healthiest thing you can do with your life. So, just as it's a really bad choice to physically kill yourself, so in the same way, why would you want to philosophically kill yourself? Why would you want to attack yourself philosophically? It amazes me that some people actually find this deep or something, but why would you want to philosophically attack yourself, tear yourself into little pieces, literally, which is what Buddhism does, and prove that you don't exist? Was your childhood that bad? So, I know the economy is not so good right now, but, there is life after bad mortgages. So Krishna consciousness, one of our main points is that you are a person. You're really a person because you come from a person. The root of your existence is a supreme person, an infinite person, God. And now, for example, let's say someone is very rich or very powerful politically, and that person believes that because I'm very rich and powerful, I don't have to bother being nice to people. I don't have to be polite. I can butt in line. I just don't have to bother treating people nicely because I'm rich and powerful. Would you respect that person? No. So in the same way, the good news is that even though God is infinitely rich and powerful, He's actually a nice guy. So, to love, like to care about your family, to care about your friends, to love other people, to be kind, to be generous, these are not material things. These qualities actually come from the soul. Now, generosity, kindness, love, they become corrupted in this world. For example, I'm kind to my people, and other people basically can drop dead for all I care, because you're not my people. You can see how it's not that generosity is material. It's ultimately spiritual. It actually comes from the soul. But material generosity is called material because it's limited. Because we limit it based on some material principle. Like, your body is not like my body. Like, my body is a certain color, or I have a certain kind of body, and I really only care about people that have bodies that are kind of like my body. Or I only care about bodies that are genetically or biologically related to my body. Unfortunately, you do not have a close biological connection with me, and therefore I don't really care about you, and I have absolutely no interest in being generous to you. So we call a quality like generosity, kindness, love, we call it material. Not because those qualities are material. They're not. They're ultimately spiritual. But they're material because of the way in which they are limited. Because of the way in which they are restricted. And if you take away the artificial restrictions, they are actually spiritual qualities. The reason I mention this is because God Himself, Krishna, as we say, the word Krishna, by the way, is not a sectarian, fanatical, my God can beat up your God name for the Supreme. It actually describes the glory of God. The word, the Sanskrit root Krish, means to attract. That's why Krishi, for example, means plowing in Sanskrit, or agriculture, because think of the relationship in English between the words attraction and traction, like tractor. Think of someone who is an attractor and someone, well, I don't think anyone actually is a tractor, but think of the word tractor. So what is the relationship between these two words, tractor and attractor? Or traction, as in a motorized vehicle, and attraction. The relationship, the semantic relationship between these two words is that attraction means mental traction. Just like a tractor pulls something, so an attractor mentally pulls. So some people, like a beautiful person, is literally, you could say, a mental tractor with a lot of horsepower. So the same thing in Sanskrit, just like in English we have traction, attraction. I think in German, isn't it Ziehung, Anziehung? Yes. So similarly in Sanskrit, that's why this, from the same root, Krish, you can get a word for God who is infinitely attractive and a word for plowing. That's not just one of the zany aspects of Sanskrit. There's actually a logical relationship. So Krishna is all attractive. He's infinitely attractive. That's what the Krish, Krishna means. And Na is an abbreviation of the well-known Sanskrit root Nand, as in Ananda, or Nanda, pleasure. So Krishna means that God is infinitely attractive and the source of all pleasure. And God is infinitely attractive not merely because he's incredibly good-looking, which he is, but also Krishna is infinitely attractive because he's morally attractive. We are attracted to people who are good people. Goodness itself, virtue, is attractive. If you meet someone who has absolute integrity, who is absolutely honest and generous, if you think about it, the most attractive quality in a person is their virtue. And if someone is very good looking and witty and all that, but is really a bad person, like they do all kinds of nasty things to other people, it's not the kind of person you necessarily want to hang out with. So ultimately the most attractive feature of Krishna is his goodness. And it's precisely because of that goodness that he comes to this world, because we're all kind of like stuck here. So that's an introduction, a little introduction to Lord Nrisimhadeva's appearance. But I wanted to explain philosophically why and how Krishna appears. I mean, if you think about it, there are all kinds of limits placed upon us, limits of knowledge, limits of happiness. I mean, we can know so much but not more. We can enjoy so much but not more. And so Krishna comes to remove these limits and to give us unlimited happiness and knowledge. Now, another thing I wanted to mention is the fact that according to the... Are you going to do something right now? Could you do that afterwards? Is that possible? Yeah, because it's... Yeah, that's probably not a great idea right now. So could you do it after the class? Or mentally, or mystically, or... Thank you. So, there is another false idea that to have a form is to be limited. There's an idea that God wouldn't have a body because a body obviously has a form and has a shape, and forms are limiting. And God is unlimited, and therefore God has no form. This is actually not good philosophy for a few reasons. It's sort of like superficially it sounds logical, but if you scrutinize this further, it has all kinds of logical problems in it. So I'll just bring out a few of those logical problems. One logical problem is that, well, we can give all kinds of counter analogies. That we can give so many examples where giving a form to something actually removes its limitations as opposed to limiting. For example, let's say you all came here and you heard that I was going to speak and I got up here and I just began, let's say, growling. Like, I know. You all know what growling is. So, and what if like at first you thought, oh my God, this is like a really novel approach to a Hare Krishna lecture. Like, I wonder what philosophical point he's going to make out of this. And what if it turned out after a while, no, there is no philosophical point, he's really just growling. And it looks like he's going to go on growling, and so we take him off the seat and, you know, find some way to help him. He's obviously been under too much stress lately. So now, the reason I bring up that point is, and don't worry, I have no intention of growling at you. So, the reason I bring up that point is because we have an apparatus inside our bodies by which we can make sound. There's a whole vocal apparatus which we're blessed with. Now, when I, instead of just making noise like that, if I start forming, if I not only make noise, but I start shaping it and forming it, then it starts to take on meaning, or more meaning. So that if you, because actually in grammar this is called morphology, form. So morphology is, studies the structure of languages. It turns out to be the case, as people that try in vain to get computers to really talk to each other in a serious way, you know, in terms of human conversation. The point is that grammar, the normal grammar that we use when we talk, is actually an extremely, extremely sophisticated structure of sound. They've actually tried with the most sophisticated computers, and it's very, very, I mean, obviously you can get computers, like when a computer hears this, and the computer says that, and so on. But it's not the type of creative, spontaneous conversation that human beings actually have, because language is one of the most, has one of the most sophisticated structures of anything in the world. Extremely sophisticated and complicated, the morphology of language. And so, actually, to be a good speaker, to be able to convey more and more meaning, the more you can shape language, the more you can structure language, the more meaning you can convey. So language itself, which is actually perhaps the central point of culture, language itself is an example of something which increases in meaning and increases in value the more it gets structured. And if you take our bodies, for example, I mean, if you just had a bunch of, you've all heard this thing, like you can take all the chemicals that are in the body and just, I don't know how much they used to cost, $1.98. Probably now something like, you know, $30,000 or something. But anyway, if you take all the basic chemicals that are in the body, you just have a bunch of chemicals. It's precisely because of the structure, the biological structures, the almost infinitely complex biological structures of our body that allow us, at least in this body, to live and to move and to do, I mean, think of the structure of the brain. So we, and think of music. I mean, if you know anything about music, it's all about mathematical ratios. It just happens to be the case that certain mathematical ratios are pleasing to an average human ear, assuming you're not under a certain age and you're not intoxicated. But anyway, so it's ratios, that's what chords are, that's what harmony. Harmony is just, basically it's the art of manipulating mathematical ratios between sounds, between pitch. And so, I mean, whether you want to talk about language, music, art, all different kinds of art, if you want to talk about biology, basically we can go on and on giving examples where structure and form adds value and meaning and beauty to something as opposed to taking it away. So the idea that form limits things, period, that's like this simplistic, not very thoughtful cliche, that form is limiting, I mean, whoever says that is really not paying attention. Now, to the real world. Now another point, even if you say that to have a certain spatial definition is limiting, like for example, this microphone has a certain shape, so the contour, the shape of this microphone precisely defines where it starts and where it stops. And so it's limited because it has a definition. So to have a spatial definition, to have a form, means there's something outside of that form and something inside of the form. And so if something's outside of it, the form is not absolute. It's not all-inclusive. That's like the basic idea. Which is, I mean, it's nice. The only problem with this somewhat naive argument is that it's based on material physics. And it's actually circular reasoning, because it assumes that there could not be a non-physical or non-material physics, so that you could have a form. For example, to give an example of spiritual physics, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that everything is in me and I am in everything. Now, try to demonstrate, according to material physics, that you are in the room and at the same time the room is within you. Try. So, The idea is that's the nature of material physics. Now, when we say that God has a form, if we assume it's a material form that obeys the laws of material physics, then we could say God's form is limiting. But in fact, God's form is not material and is not under the laws of material physics. And therefore, to say if God had a form, he would be limited, or she would be limited, or they would be limited, and so on, it assumes things which you obviously can't assume according to common logic. First of all, because it's completely circular reasoning. You're assuming the very thing you're trying to prove. If you're trying to prove that all forms are material, then you can prove it by assuming that all forms are material. So when you assume, what you're trying to prove is already true, and therefore proves what you're trying to prove because it's already true, I mean, that doesn't sound logical to you, does it? It's not. It's circular reasoning. And so therefore, the so-called intellectual objections to a personal God who has a spiritual form turn out to be actually a lack of serious thinking and paying attention to things like logic, biology, music, language, art, and many other aspects of the real world. So, basically, Krishna consciousness is teaching and really demonstrating by inviting people to come and experience it for themselves that there is a personal God who has an infinitely attractive personal form. And Krishna or God comes to this world to help us out. After all, if you love someone, say like your own children, are there any parents here who, if you saw your children in difficulty, wouldn't go to help them? So, there is a loving relationship, a natural, eternal loving relationship between ourselves and God, such that when God sees that we're in difficulty, which is usually the case, He comes. God comes. Actually, He and She, because the Absolute Truth includes the masculine and feminine aspect, Radha Krishna, Lakshmi Narayan, Sita Ram, and so on. So gender, I mean, just to avoid the whole, to preempt the whole gender ecstasy. Actually, as Prabhupada explained, male and female, which when they're functioning properly are complementary, when they're not, they're usually divorcing each other. But when male and female are actually functioning properly, there is this amazing complementarity. So that if there were only males in the world or only females, you probably want to transfer to another planet. So this male-female, this complementarity actually comes from God. So therefore when Krishna comes, it's like when Nisringa comes, it's understood Lakshmi Nisringa. I mean, Lakshmi didn't come out of the pillar, but Nisringa in terms of his eternal form is with Lakshmi. So when God comes, that's a great thing. It's like there's a song, the music for it was written by George Handel, that joy to the world, the Lord has come. So this is it's a great idea. I mean, the power of that song, joy to the world, the Lord has come, the power of that song is that it's true. The Lord actually does come to the world. And so there may be specific doctrines in different religions, but the basic concept that the joy to the world, the Lord has come, that basic notion or idea is actually a true one. The Lord's coming to the world really is the joy of the world. Now, we shouldn't understand the Lord's coming fanatically, because fanaticism is just not, it's just really a dead end, spiritually and philosophically and everything. But the Lord does come. So Nrsimha, the specific incarnation, for those of you who wondered if I would ever actually get around to it. So if any of you have like private bets going, the ones that bet against me mentioning the string are going to lose here. So, Krishna is very youthful, and so he came as half man, half lion, the torso of a human being, and the head and the claws of a lion, which is very creative. I mean, it's the kind of thing, imagine, if you say, like, why would God come like that, think of a young person, or an older person, doing drama, think theater. You know, it's creative, it's a creative thing to do. It's innovative. And so, The idea is not that God plays like a young person, but that God actually is an eternal youth. And that, so Krishna comes in all these very innovative, creative forms to play here in this world. Not to play in the sense that our suffering is just a joke or a game. No, God takes our suffering very seriously, and He very sincerely wants to help us. But He plays in the sense that even as He does everything, actually, to help us, He's still Himself, playful, youthful, and does things in very creative, innovative ways, which is for our benefit. It's not whimsical play. It's not whimsy. Because God plays in a way that is ultimately in our self-interest. Now, if I'm playful in a way which in no way benefits you, you would say it's whimsical, it's just my own personal whimsy. But if I play in a way that ultimately is most beneficial for you, then it's not whimsy. It actually combines play with the most earnest pragmatism. And actually, the pragmatic aspect of Krishna's play is not just that He comes at all, but that He creates these wonderful dramas that we can hear about and be interested in. Because otherwise, you're just sort of stuck for the rest of your life saying, God is great, God is good, God is merciful. And it's like, I mean, it's nice to say that, but it's also fun to hear stories. So Krishna actually comes and He creates this drama, He creates this spiritual theater, so that you can emotionally engage yourself. Because all of us, you know, everyone loves a great movie, of which there are very, very few. Anyway, we won't go into the whole movie industry thing. So, but still, when a good movie comes out, we love a good story. Who doesn't love a great story, a powerful story? It's cathartic. You know, you can cry, you can laugh, and the lights are turned out so no one sees, you know, that you're crying. So we love, it's actually purifying. I mean, catharsis means purification, to get emotionally engaged, to see a great story. So Krishna comes to this world and creates the super theater so that we can emotionally engage ourselves in relation to God. And that's yoga. Yoga means a link. Krishna is giving us the possibility to connect ourselves, not just by mystic meditation, but holistically, engaging all of our emotions, our intelligence, our everything. We can engage our entire being in relationship to God. And thus purify our whole being, because it's by that yoga, by that link to God, that we become purified. God is the secret cleansing agent in bhakti yoga. So the idea is we become purified by direct contact with Krishna. And you have to contact Krishna not merely intellectually and not merely religiously, but you have to connect yourself holistically to Krishna at every level of your existence. So that emotionally, intellectually, religiously, spiritually, socially, sensorially, you know, your tongue tasting things and seeing things. At every level, we have to connect our entire existence to Krishna so that our whole existence becomes purified. And there's no part of us... I mean, think for those of you who know Indian culture, you'll know the famous story of Mahabharata, where, at least the story goes, that Gandhari wanted to protect her son Duryodhana in battle, and she had the power to sort of grant this immunity or this invulnerability by her glance. And so she told him to take all his clothes off so she could see his body and sort of, you know, make it invulnerable. But he was a little shy about, you know, he's a grown man, didn't want to come before his mother naked, and so he covered the embarrassing part of his body, and therefore, that part wasn't protected, and that's where Bhima hit him, and of course, he was killed. So, the reason, you all know this story, right? So, the reason I mention this is because any part of your existence that is not linked to Krishna, that's where Maya will strike you. That will be your, so to speak, Achilles heel, or your Duryodhana's thigh. So, any part of your existence that is not connected to Krishna, will be your downfall spiritually. And that's why Prabhupada, I mean, it was Prabhupada's genius, it was Lord Chaitanya's genius, just the genius of this eternal bhakti yoga. That it gives us the opportunity to connect every part of ourselves to God through eating, through singing, dancing, through philosophy, through friendship, through falling in love. Every part of ourselves can be connected to Krishna and must be connected to Krishna so that we're immersed spiritually and actually protected from illusion and from spiritual fall down. And that's why Lord Krishna comes as he does. And Nrsingadeva came in this incredible form, because after all, he's Krishna and God, and you would expect something original, creative, right? So Krishna comes, and this particular incarnation is very special, because in this particular form, Krishna protects his devotees. Nrsingadeva, of course, is very famous. I mean, frankly, if you study world religions, you find in every religion around the world, if it lasts long enough to really develop a full range of human religiosity, you find that one of the main concerns of real people, whether it's Buddhism or Hinduism or Christianity or Judaism or Islam, whatever it is, one of the main concerns of people is they want to be protected by divine power in a very dangerous, unpredictable world. Because the world is very dangerous and unpredictable. I mean, if this ceiling caved in right now, we might even, you know, make the national media. In the international media, because roofs aren't supposed to cave in the United States. But it could happen. I mean, you read about it all the time. I mean, if you are like totally into the bizarre and the weird, you have nothing more to do than to follow mainstream media. And they will give you as many bizarre, impossible, weird things as anyone could ever wish for, and much more. So, this is a very dangerous and somewhat crazy world that we live in. And frankly, the world's always been kind of nutty. Therefore, you find throughout the history of religions, people want protection. They want security for themselves and their loved ones. And Krishna, recognizing this natural human desire and need, has designed a particular incarnation of his, to give that kind of comfort and security to his devotees. And in the Vaishnava culture, that figure especially is Lord Nrsingadeva, who protected Prahlad. Of course, I'll give the story very briefly, because I don't want to go on much longer. And that is that there was a sort of like, I don't know what you'd call him, the Hitler of his times or whatever, Hiranyakashipu. You heard of Goldfinger, this was Gold Pillow. Sounds like a James Bond movie, you know, Gold Pillow. So, anyway, Hiranyakashipu, basically, he was like a demon's demon. He's your classic demon. Because by demon, we mean someone who actually is devoted to causing harm to innocent people for their own selfish satisfaction. So, Hiranyakashipu manipulating the yoga process, he actually was a great yogi, which shows that you can be a yogi and a very bad person, because yoga in the physical sense is just a material technique. And so you can use any material technology for good or evil, right? And yoga is a sophisticated material technology, which Hiranyakashipu, I mean, he could have probably given fantastic hatha yoga classes. And it would have had a little, like a full room there, but he was a great, in fact, he was such an austere yogi, he fasted, he eventually, like, over time, lost all the flesh in his body, kept his prana, his life air circulating in his bones. I mean, we're talking about over-the-top hatha yoga. So Hiranyakashipu was this great yogi, he acquired all this cosmic power. The only problem was he was really an evil person who was completely against the very idea of God. He hated God. He actually despised God. Despised Vishnu. And so, as fate would have it, his son, he had a son who was hoping to raise to be a, you know, not a world class, because you'd call him cosmic demon. His son turned out to be extremely religious. And imagine if you were See, the old Bolshevik days, like if Lenin would have had a son that was like really religious and just wanted to be an Orthodox priest or something. So, here you have Hiranyakashipu, this big demon. His son was extremely religious. His son was actually a great saint, one of the most famous saints of all time. A person who was fully in love with God. And so, to make a long story short, Hiranyakashipu did not celebrate the diversity. He rather tried by every possible means to kill his own child. His child was 5 years old. When you kill your child over ideological disputes, then you're getting pretty medieval. So, anyway, Hiranyakashipu tried by every possible means to kill his own 5-year-old, this beautiful 5-year-old boy, and failed because Krishna kept protecting him. And finally, in complete frustration, Hiranyakashipu pulled out his sword, which was a cosmic sword. It wasn't like, I mean, it was very high tech. It wasn't just like an ordinary earthly sword. And he challenged, he said, "Where do you get your power?" He couldn't stand it that he couldn't kill his own son. So he said, "Where do you get this power?" And so Prahlad, being a saintly devotee, gave him a philosophical answer. He said, "My power comes from the same place your power comes from." It's sort of like a Vedanta type answer. You know, the absolute is the source of everything. So this was not the answer Hiranyakashipu was looking for. And it further enraged him, and so he said, "Where is this God?" And so again, Prahlad gave him a philosophical answer. He said, "God is everywhere. God is all pervading." So then Hiranyakashipu, you know, that was enough philosophy for him. So he said, let's test this philosophy. So he said, "Okay, if your God is everywhere, is he in the pillar of this palace?" And Prahlad looked and said, "Yeah, he's there." So Hiranyakashipu thought he had like the ultimate argument to disprove the existence of God. So he took his sword and smashed the pillar. You know, like, "Where's your God?" And then the bad news for Hiranyakashipu was that Krishna really wasn't a pillar. And so then Krishna came out, and it actually ruined Hiranyakashipu's whole day. So this cosmic battle ensued, and Hiranyakashipu actually tried to put up a fight, but it was, you know, he was seriously outgunned. And finally, Nrisimha took him on his lap and ripped him apart. Of course, not him, he's an eternal soul, but so he was, he was, as I say, as dead as you can get. And so what's interesting here is that then, because it's Vaishnavism, this is not like some, you know, savage religious doctrine. So Lord Nrisimhadeva then said to his devotee, "Prahlad, you know, I'm so pleased with you because of your love for me, I'll fulfill any wish you have." And Prahlad said, "You know, personally, I'm okay, because I'm satisfied with my relationship with you." But then Prahlad said that if you want me to take some wish, if you want me to take something from you, then please just give me this. Save my father. Save my father. Give him salvation. And the father was saved. So it's a very beautiful story. It's a very beautiful story. And so naturally, devotees look to Nrisimhadeva to protect us. We look to Nrisimhadeva to protect us. And so in that sense, that particular form of Krishna coming in that form, is Krishna trying to tell us that I care about you so much that I'm going to design a special incarnation just to show you how much I care about your security and how much I care about you. And so ultimately, because here we are in the material world, we have these material bodies, and we all have to leave this world at some point. So the ultimate protection that Krishna gives us, the ultimate protection is he protects our consciousness. There's this great story in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, the story of Didhi Muni, who's this great sage, a great devotee of Krishna, who at one point had to donate his body for some cosmic purpose. And it said that he was so Krishna conscious, he was so spiritually conscious, that he actually didn't notice when he lost his body. I mean, imagine if you're, let's say, dancing in ecstasy, and you're, like, you have a little chadar on, you know, a little cloth on your shoulders that slips off. You don't notice it because you're dancing next to you. You don't notice that, you know, your coat slipped, something slipped off. So Didichi Muni was so ecstatic, he actually didn't know he lost his body. It's like, sometime later he said, like, where did I put that thing? So this is so-called death. So what Prabhupada explains in his purport is that if you are really Krishna conscious, you actually don't lose consciousness at the time of your death. It's like taking off a coat. This is exactly the example Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita. Vasansi jirnani. Jirnani, just like worn out clothes. Vasansi jirnani. Jirna, from the Sanskrit, well, jira, old age, worn out, which we get words like gerontology, geriatrics. In Sanskrit, jirna, jira, and so on. So, actually, in parentheses, I can't help telling you. You know, an osteopath is a bone doctor, right? And the Sanskrit word asti, it actually means bone. Anyway, back to our matinee. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that just as you give up, vasamsi jirnjatavi, we give up, we throw away worn out clothes. So if you think about that, when you, let's say, you notice that your shirt, your coat is worn out, you throw it away. You don't like black out from the experience, like, oh my god, this is so traumatic. I'm losing consciousness because I'm throwing away this old shirt. You know, you just throw your shirt away, it's not a big deal. So in the same way, if someone is fully Krishna conscious, when you give up the body, you don't lose consciousness. It's not like you die and everything, all the lights go out, and you just, well, I hope I was right about this stuff. It's not like that. Actually, in Krishna consciousness, you remain conscious. And so by protecting our consciousness, by bringing us to this understanding that we are eternal, we are fully protected. Because all of us go through different material situations, but the ultimate protection for a soul is to bless that soul with this clear consciousness that I am invulnerable. I am eternal. Actually, I mean, think of it. Parents may punish children for their own good, but a loving parent will never actually injure their child. Loving parents don't break their children's bones or, you know, mutilate them or things like that. So in the same way, God is our loving parent, mother and father. God has never, in the history of history, I mean, in the history of life, God has never actually injured or killed a single child of his. Because Krishna puts this virtual reality machine over the soul, and then, you know, and then you go through these virtual experiences. But actually, you, the eternal person, are never injured, never killed, never get sick, because a loving parent will never injure their child. And Krishna never injures any soul. Now, if we choose to identify with this virtual reality because we're lusting after material enjoyment, then you've got to take the flip side of material enjoyment, which is material suffering. And sometimes it can get very flippy, because if we, you know, if we really try to exploit the material world, the universe is just wired to react. So the more we try to exploit the universe, the more we dig ourselves into material suffering. But if we accept we really are, you will see that you are eternal. You've actually never been injured, you've never been sick, you'll never die. You're actually an eternal person just driving this material body, which is a virtual reality machine. And to give us that consciousness, you actually realize that you're invulnerable, you're eternal. Krishna says it in the Gita, achedhyoyam, you cannot be cut. You, the person, nothing can, there's no weapon that could ever cut you. Adayo, you could never be burned, there's no fire. You could actually stand in the center of the sun and you wouldn't even get suntan, actually. You wouldn't even get tan. Because a soul, it just exists beyond all these things. A chedyoyam, a dayoyam, a kledyo. You can never drown. You can never be dissolved in liquid. Ashoja, you can never be withered, dried up, pulverized. We are absolutely invulnerable because Krishna makes us that way. And to realize our eternal invulnerability is the greatest protection. And Krishna, of course, Krishna throws in some material blocks also to help us out. So, but that Nrisinga, that is the glory of Nrisinga. And I've explained philosophically how God can be a person, how God can have an eternal form. That's not pre-philosophical, you know, belief. That's actually a very reasonable understanding of God. So, any questions on these points? Actually, it's also the day 36 years ago that I took the renounced order of life. And, which in no way was the fault of my wife. Actually, I had a very good wife. But I just had other things I was supposed to do. Yes?
So, am I understanding right when I say that Asha God has no name, every time we talk about his names, we're describing his qualities?
That's interesting. Yeah, Prabhupada has sometimes spoken like that. To say God has no name, it's like, let's say your name is Fred. I mean, what does Fred mean? I think what Prabhupada means by that is just a name. Like, for example, let's say you call a flower flower. Like, we have the two-syllable English thing we do, flower. And there's, you know, Sanskrit's pushpa, Spanish got down to one syllable. One of the few cases where Spanish is shorter than English. Flor. And, but they're just sounding, so, in other words, God doesn't have a name like Billy or Fred or Gazion or something. I mean, it's not, but the word Krishna, I mean, Krishna's present in the name, because when a sound describes God, it is God, because there's no difference in the absolute between the description, true description of the thing itself. So that Krishna, it is Krishna. So that a name can actually be the thing itself, which it isn't materially. Like water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. You can't cash in, I mean, the word water, you can't drink that sound. You can say jal, I guess in India, one of the words for water, pani or jal. I mean, you can't drink those sounds. You need the thing water. But because Krishna, spiritually, thing, the name and the thing, the nam and the nami, the name and that which is named are identical. So it really is Krishna. Because the description, the true description, becomes the thing itself. That's why every religious culture in the world talks about the holy name, by the way. Every religious culture in the world talks about the holy name of God. Yes?
What's the difference between religion?
Yeah, something we should think about a little more often, I think. The way those words are used nowadays, popularly, like people, like Americans, they often say, well, I'm not very religious, but I think I'm a spiritual person. And so, if you take religion to mean, or to refer to external behavior, using this popular sense of the word, like the spiritual-religious dichotomy, then if religious refers to external observable behavior, like I go to church, or I go to the temple, or I go here, or I go there, or I say these prayers, or I abstain from certain foods, or I perform certain rituals. So in this popular sense, if you take religion to be external behavior, and if you take spiritual to mean a certain state of consciousness, and a behavior, just a general behavior, the way you treat other people, the way you treat yourself, the way you treat the world, based on a certain state of consciousness. Then, Rupa Goswami says that actually both are needed. We can't just reject the external behavior, because then there'll be no, what does it say, like check and balance. Because if we disassociate external behavior from spiritual states of consciousness, then anyone can claim to be spiritual. Like I can go and, you know, blow a bunch of innocent people and say, well, I know, but I'm a spiritual person. Or if you're like the Beatles, Prabhupada was once talking to the Beatles, not, he wasn't communicating with insects, he was talking to the musicians. And I think John Lennon asked Prabhupada, how do you know who's really spiritually advanced, more or less? And Prabhupada said, you have to look to see who's addicted to God. In other words, if someone claims to love God, but is not really that interested in God, like, do you want to come and sing about God? No, I think I'm going to, you know, I want to go to a Monday movie. Do you want to talk about God? No, not really. So that is some external behavior which corroborates. It's just natural. Because like if you love someone, I remember when I was a kid in school, several centuries ago, when I was a kid in school that like everyone always knew if someone was falling in love with someone else or had a crush on someone, as they say in America, you always knew it, you know, and they may say like, hey, you really like so-and-so. No, I don't. Why are you saying that? And it's like, but everyone knew it. And so, I mean, it's just love is something which you, it's really hard to hide. And that's why people, like sometimes let's say two people who really it should not have an intimate relationship for whatever reason, like they're married to other people, or someone is against, you know, a vow, someone say whatever. And you can tell, like, I don't think these two people have an appropriate relationship. It's just the real world. Attachment, love is something which it just transforms behavior. You can't really hide it. So that's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that even though enlightened people don't need to perform all these rituals, they do it anyway, first of all, just to lead, to give a good example for other people, but also because they enjoy it. I mean, Prabhupada once asked, what's the result of chanting Hare Krishna? He said, more chanting. Because you may chant Hare Krishna because it's a rule, but then you come to the platform where you want to do it. So as far as a religion, I would say the extent to which, I mean, the word movement means that a group of people care very deeply. They have a central concern with helping other people to come to wisdom. That's actually a central concern, and it's one of their most important activities. And to be spiritual, I would say that they would have to place in a very high value, they would have to consider essential that people not merely follow certain external formulas and rituals and things like that, but they actually have a very deep, primary, central concern with bringing people to truly spiritual states of consciousness. So, yes?
Maharaj, we say that every living being, they have body. And everything is a personality. And each personality has a body.
Yes.
So once it comes to us, I am as a person, then we learn that, no, I am not this body, I am a spirit soul. So where this aspect matches, that, you know...
Well, Prabhupada gave an example, consider Krishna's example of the clothes. If you, let's say you see an actor on stage, or in a movie, and sometimes for different roles, the actor has to, is like completely, I mean their costume, they may wear a mask, but you know, the actor may play a part where you really can't see any of their face. Either wear a mask or they have such, they've been so totally transformed with makeup that you really have no idea what the person actually looks like. And so, and you see the person moving, but the reason the clothes are moving, the costume is moving to the person inside. And so the reason what's moving the body is the soul. As soon as the soul leaves the body just, you know, down it goes. It starts to disintegrate. So this body is literally animated right now. It's moving, it's talking and walking because I'm inside of it. Because that's why my shirt is moving. My shirt doesn't have the power of, you know, self-movement. The shirt is moving because my body is moving. My body is moving because I, as a soul, am moving inside this body. I am dynamic. And that's why the body is moving.
What is our form?
Our spiritual form? You'll find out. I mean, your spiritual form is, in the spiritual world, you are your body. You are your body in the spiritual world, so it's a spiritual body, spiritual form. And you'll just grow into it. It's just like, a 5-year-old child saying, what do I look like as an adult? Just keep growing and you'll find out. And so, in a sense, and you could say in a sense, you're already genetically programmed, so you're adult. Even when you're a child, it's kind of already programmed what you're going to look like as an adult if you don't do something bad to yourself. So, in the same way, your spiritual form is there. You just have to grow into it. And a spiritual body is actually the expression of consciousness. So, because the spiritual world, people have very beautiful consciousness, they have very beautiful forms, because the body is the visible expression of their consciousness. So as you grow into your eternal consciousness, as you revive and remember and wake up to your eternal consciousness, there you are. Yes, Mauricio.
Could you please tell us a little bit about your decision and experience of taking sannyas?
Oh, my experience and decision of taking sannyas, of taking up a renounced order of life. Well, actually I took sannyas at the mature, experienced age of 23. I guess according to modern science, my young male brain maybe was still solidifying. I don't know if my head was still soft somewhere, but in those days we were extremely enthusiastic. Prabhupada really had us revved up. And this Prabhupada himself was just, completely a Krishna conscious person, so he had us so enlivened. We were young, and it was an idealistic age. It was an age, if I had a hammer, nowadays if I had a hammer, I'd sell it and I'd invest that in maybe some, repossessed houses, and then if I had some repossessed houses, then I'd try. Anyway, that's like the modern version of if I had a hammer. So, but in those days, there was a certain idealism in the world. There was a certain idealism in the world, and so we came. I know I went to school as a young man. I went to school in Berkeley, California, right in the middle of all the whatever it was, the revolution. I mean, I was really there. I really like at the epicenter of it. And so we had this idealistic revolutionary spirit, and we met this pure devotee, and it was a very explosive combination. So, at the age of 23, I realized that I knew all there was to know. It reminds me of the thing Mark Twain said once, that when he was a young man, he got frustrated because his parents didn't understand anything, so he left home. And he came back a few years later, and he was amazed at how much his parents had learned in his absence. So, anyway, so at the age of 23, I took sannyas. I had a renounced order of life, and it was positive. As I said, I had an excellent wife, who was still a very excellent devotee, an excellent person. And in that sense, I was really fortunate. But I somehow had this mission. It was somehow my destiny to dedicate all of my energy, not to domestic affairs, but to teaching Krishna consciousness. And actually, I should give a lot of credit to my wife, who eventually remarried, has beautiful children, and it was also, I think, her generosity, because she was and is an excellent devotee, and it actually was her generosity that allowed me to devote all my energy not to some other girl that actually I now like, but to devote myself to teaching Krishna consciousness. So I think she should also get a lot of credit. And she's also a real preacher. She was a real Gita thumper. So, So I made the, as I say, took the plunge, made the plunge, and it's really what Krishna says. I take sannyasa at the age of 23, especially coming from the background I did. It's like those cartoons where some guy's running on the roof of a building, he runs off the roof, and he's running in midair, and he doesn't fall until he looks down. Right? It's like when he looks down, and he falls. So, I just didn't look down. Then eventually I was on another roof. So somehow or other, it really was like what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, a higher taste. It was the taste of teaching Krishna consciousness, trying to help other people to come to Krishna, really is ecstatic. It really is a higher taste. And so it was that higher taste, it was Prabhupada's mercy. It was Prabhupada's Krishna special mercy that somehow they blessed me to be able to continue this life and go on. Well, this is like they used to say about Timex watches. It takes a licking, but it goes on ticking. So somehow or other, I was able to continue doing this. Which is really, like I said, I think it's a credit to my wife, her generosity and her Krishna consciousness, a credit to the power of Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada's mercy, Krishna, the sheer ecstasy of teaching Krishna consciousness. So, anything else? Yes? Yes, yes.
But then subsequently you also followed up saying, in the history of time, God has never injured any of his sons.
Yes.
So the soul by nature cannot be injured by anyone. Why do we give credit? What did you mean by saying Krishna never injured us?
Because the body is injured. But the body, obviously, Krishna himself says that janma mrityu jara vyadi dukkha dosh anudarshana. Anudarshan, we should always pay attention to the fact that this world has the defects, dosh, has the defects of birth, death, old age, and disease. So Krishna is calling our attention to these things, but he's telling us that these things are not really happening to us. These things are not happening to us. They're actually happening to the body. Now, the problem is that we are in the body, and we identify with the body, and therefore psychologically we very much, you know, experience what the body experiences. But Krishna's trying to persuade us to recognize our real selves, that you really are an eternal, invulnerable person. And so the problem in a sense is not medical or biological, the problem is psychological. The problem is psychological. The problem is a state of mind in which we identify with something. I mean, imagine, for example, let's say someone who, give an example, a contemporary example, there was just an earthquake in China. So imagine a parent that believes that their child has been killed. And now imagine that it turns out the child's not killed. There was actually a false report or whatever. Now the parents believe their child is dead. In fact, the child is not dead. Instead, the child is doing well, being taken care of. So therefore, the cause of the suffering is not the death of the child. The cause of the suffering is a false belief. And therefore, the real problem is psychological. In the sense that the problem is a misunderstanding. So all of our suffering, and we really suffer, but all of our suffering is actually a misunderstanding. And that's what Krishna is trying to tell us. And that's why Krishna praises knowledge, why knowledge is in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, at the end of chapter 4 especially, praises knowledge. He says that, sadrasham pavitram iha vidyate. What? Yeah, thank you. Naigyanena sadrasham pavitram iha vidyate. Thank you very much. Naigyanena Sadrusham Pavitram Iha Vidyate Tatsayam Yoga Sansetha Kalinadmani Vindate. Yes, so Krishna said there's nothing as purifying, as sublime in this world as knowledge. So again, imagine a person, a parent, who's in agony, who's suffering the worst kind of pain. But it's a mistake. It's actually a mistake. So that's our situation. We actually, our suffering is based on a misunderstanding of who we are and who other people are. You understand?
I probably didn't know about that question very good.
Let's try again.
I was asking, Krishna. So in this particular example, we know that Krishna actually injured Hiranyakashipu's body.
Yes, his body, exactly.
Also his,
yeah, I didn't say that Krishna ever injures anyone's body.
Right, so when he said Krishna never injures anybody's soul, but the soul is not injured with anything.
Yes.
And nobody can injure anyone else.
Yes, so exactly. That's exactly what Krishna says. Kam gatiyati hanti kam. How can you kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? That's exactly what Krishna says. So how are we protected? Is that your question?
See, when I had this statement, I was seeing Krishna as very special because he never injures
right.
any of his sons.
Children, yes.
Children. So it's, if that's not possible anyway, why do we give extra credit to Krishna
anyway? Why? Well, first of all, never injuring anyone, I think, is, you know, people sometimes get credit for that. And Krishna protects our, I mean, imagine, what if, for example, someone in China, let's say you knew that someone was suffering because they falsely thought their child was killed. And so someone took it upon themselves to go and tell that person. I mean, don't you think that's the person, the parents would be grateful that someone took the trouble. And also, Krishna is protecting us. He is protecting us because in our conditioned state, even though we're not really suffering, or at least the body, you know, the body is suffering, not the soul, but because we are attached to our bodies, even though we are practicing bhakti yoga, even though we are trying to love Krishna, at the present time, we still are attached to our bodies. And therefore, we are very much subject to all kinds of suffering. So, Krishna, it's almost like saying that, let's say a person's sick, and therefore they're suffering because they're sick. Now, in the healthy state, the person won't suffer. They're only suffering because of the disease. But they are diseased and they are suffering. So the doctor dedicates herself or himself to helping that sick person is really doing something good. To bring them to a healthy state where they won't suffer. So we are now suffering because our consciousness is sick. Our consciousness is diseased. And that's our ignorance. So Krishna is not injuring us. But we are still suffering because of our this disease of our consciousness. And therefore Krishna takes steps to treat us, to cure us, to help us, to cure this disease so that we don't unnecessarily suffer. And therefore Krishna deserves all credit. Because our suffering does have a cause, whatever it may be, and Krishna, with great compassion and diligence, is addressing that cause. Yes. The microphone.
She made a great point about Krishna attacking us at our weakest point.
Maya.
Maya, sorry. But you mentioned all the different points that we have to have covered, and one of them was socially. How do we, if we see not the perfect social situation,
right?
How are we supposed to align ourselves with in that protection when there are obvious faults and
yes, yes,
lackings?
Yeah. We'll take a commercial break here. Okay, we're back. A few things I would say. Number one, Krishna gives an example that I think he's talking about consciousness, a devotee in right consciousness. It's like a lotus flower that floats on the water but never gets submerged. And so we have to be spiritually strong, and that really depends on us, because you or me or anyone, we have the right to chant Hare Krishna sincerely, and we can make spiritual advancement. No one can stop us from doing it, and no one can force us to do it. So if we are, in general, serious about our spiritual life, whatever situation we're in, then it'll, in a sense, give us the freedom to be nice to other people. We won't be so needy socially. So, for example, myself, there are times when I had to go away on writing retreats. I think those times are coming again. And I noticed myself that, let's say I'm in a place there's hardly any devotees at all. And writing is sort of a lonely profession. And so if I'm out in the country and my only association is such intellectual things as trees and squirrels, I mean, I love nature and all that, but those are the only people you can talk to. They're not going to be very long conversations. So I found myself that when I'm writing, when I'm in a situation where I'm not around any devotees, I just like to be around people. It's almost like you need sunshine, because chemically it does something on your skin and produces some chemicals that makes you, you know, it makes you feel good. And so I find that just like taking a japa walk in a place where there's people and just smiling at people and thinking in my mind that this person is part of Krishna, it actually satisfies a certain human need I have. Because even though I'm a spirit soul, I have a human body, physical body, I have a human mind. And there are certain needs we have, but which can be satisfied without putting yourselves at the mercy of people who don't have the best social skills in the world or who may not be able to fairly reciprocate with you, and so on. And so I think our social needs have to be balanced with our individual private responsibilities, chief of which is to keep ourselves strong spiritually. And so, let's say you're in a community where it's not your dream team community, it's not everything you ever imagined and wished for in a community, but you're there. So I would say that in a situation like that, first of all, there's always some, you know, nice people you can relate to. And I would, there's a great line in Jane Austen. Which book is it in? Bhakti and Jane. I think it's in Emma, where Emma gets this realization that universal goodwill, but not universal friendship. In the sense that even Rupa Goswami, in the Upadeshamrita, advises us to sort of evaluate different levels of spiritual advancement, people we meet, and to form friendships appropriately. So, because there are basically three kinds of relationships with devotees. And that is, we should serve and follow those who are clearly more advanced. We should make friendship with those who are roughly on our level. And we should be sort of kind toward those who maybe are not doing as well as we are spiritually at the moment. And the frustration really is if you feel you're trapped in or forced into inappropriate relationships. But if you keep these three things straight, because everyone you meet is in one of these three categories, either more advanced than you, roughly like you, or maybe not as advanced. And so if you, in your own dealings, sort of keep these relationships appropriate, so that you're not drawn into inappropriate intimacy with someone who really is not, you know what I mean? Can't reciprocate. So you have to choose your friends wisely. And I think it's a question of just judging or establishing different levels of intimacy according to what is appropriate and, you know, just what's going to work for us. But at the same time, if we're Krishna conscious, we have the luxury of being nice to everyone. So therefore, we're not talking about cliques or you know, a little tribal thing like this is our little sub-communal tribe and that's your sub-communal tribe. And it's not that. It's not us and them. It's not little, you know, Gaudiya Vaishnava gangs or anything. It's rather be nice to everyone, sincerely nice, because everyone ultimately is spirit soul, and at the same time have enough respect for yourself to carefully choose where and to what extent you will cultivate greater intimacy. And so I think if all your relationships are appropriate based on these three categories, you won't be frustrated. And you can always find good people in this world.
Thank you.
Yes, our next contestant.
I work in a very large organization.
In a what?
In a very large organization.
Yes.
And sometimes I have to compromise on my values, you know, being nice to everybody.
Yes.
And that causes a lot of anguish and frustration at the end of the day.
Because you feel you haven't been as nice as you would like.
Exactly.
Well, Krishna's raising the bar. It's like when you go to a gym, you go to a fitness club or something like that, you go to challenge yourself, to exercise yourself, and so you can't do too much exercise because you'll hurt yourself, and you can't do too little. So the whole universe is just like this big spiritual fitness club. And actually every situation we find ourselves in is just Krishna, it's just another exercise machine. So think of your very large corporation as just like this huge apparatus for you to work out on. And work out. You know, it's a challenge. See if you can do better. And that's what it is. That's all the universe is, really. It's just this, I mean, it's an amazing universe Krishna created. But really, the whole purpose is just, it's just a big fitness club. And Krishna is the supreme personality and personal trainer in your heart. So that's the way we should look at everything. So then the most annoying people are just, you know, sort of like these really cool exercise machines. Hang on, I'll give you that advice. I have no intention of following it myself. Because I reserve the right to be very annoyed. But anyway. So it's yeah, that's what we should do. Krishna is our personal trainer. Personal trainer in the heart. Our life coach. So, perhaps we'll end here. Now, Kirtan Prasadam, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai, Narasingha Dev Ki Jai.
Jai!